Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. In the news this week, Parkland, Florida school shooting survivors march on Tallahassee to push gun law reform. Cheryl Acquaroli had this message for lawmakers.
The next person who dies because of an AR-15 will be on you! Yes!
In an emotional listening session, President Trump floats the idea of arming teachers.
It's called concealed carry, and it only works where you have people very adept at using firearms, of which you have many. And it would be teachers and coaches.
Famed evangelical preacher Billy Graham died this week at the age of 99. In a 1988 interview with Larry King, Graham said death is something he did not fear.
When I come to the moment of death, I believe that at that moment, there's going to be an angel that will take me by the hand and usher me into the presence of the Lord. And I'm going to be in his presence, and it's going to be the most peaceful, the most wonderful, the most thrilling moment that I have ever experienced.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with David Smiley of the Miami Herald, Aaron Blake of the Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. One week on, how are you thinking about the school shootings? Are you standing with the students calling for gun reform? Standing with the NRA? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. David Smiley is a political reporter for the Miami Herald. He's been covering the Parkland shooting and its aftermath. David, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
With us in Washington is Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for the Washington Post. Aaron, always great to have you.
Thank you for having me again.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Ray, David, and Aaron.
Aaron, today, Friday, after days of rumors and reports, the New York Times has nailed down, or to its own satisfaction, I'll hear if your paper's ready to confirm it, the fact that Rick Gates, Paul Manafort's assistant, a Trump campaign staffer until the end of the campaign, is going to plead guilty, is going to testify. How does this change the picture for the Mueller prosecutions?
Well, it's obviously very early. We just learned about this in the last half an hour or so. The New York Times is reporting it. I don't believe that other outlets, including us, have confirmed it. It's not a huge surprise at this point. There have been a number of maneuvers behind the scenes involving who exactly is representing Mr. Gates, what his legal team looks like. There were, of course, the additional charges that were indictments that were filed on Thursday by the Mueller investigation, ratcheting up the pressure on both Manafort and Gates. It was pretty clear that if there was one figure in this investigation who was going to be cooperating going forward, that the next one was most likely to be Mr. Gates, and now that's the case. The big question I would say from here is, what does he know about? The indictment on Thursday was the first one that actually involved financial transactions and actions that were taken while these two men were on the campaign. At the same time, they don't actually involve campaign business, so we don't know what Mr. Gates and Mr. Manafort were party to that may have been problematic. What we do know is that Mr. Gates was on the airplane with Trump frequently. He was an advisor through Election Day. He certainly carved a bigger profile than the previous aides who have pleaded guilty in the Mueller investigation. That'd be George Papadopoulos and a lower level aide who was recently pleaded guilty. So we're going to find out now, but certainly this ups the pressure on Paul Manafort. And the idea has long been that this would be about trying to get Manafort to flip. And if he does, obviously that would be very significant given that he was the chairman of the entire campaign.
Jack Beatty, one of the things that the Trump administration and its spokespeople have said all along is a kind of distancing maneuver. Well, Paul Manafort didn't last the whole campaign. He was gone fairly early and so on. Rick Gates is a little different. As Aaron mentions, he stayed on the campaign. He was the liaison with the Republican National Committee all the way up until Election Day. So there may be things he knows, but certainly Paul Manafort's defense team is probably watching these developments very closely.
Indeed, and he's facing, Paul Manafort, is what Larry Tribe, the law professor, tweets out this morning, is the choice, flip or die in jail. That these charges against him, bank fraud, tax evasion and the like, money laundering, are enough to put him away for the rest of his natural life. Now, is he going to be a Gordon Liddy figure and take the hit for the president? That is, assuming there is even a hit to take. We don't know, but he is now under tremendous pressure to tell everything he knows and maybe even to make up a thing or two. That's never seemed to stop him before.
Of course, this week's news plays out in the shadow of the shooting at the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida. At a CNN town hall Wednesday night, Florida Senator Marco Rubio faced questioning from Fred Guttenberg, the father of a 14-year-old who was killed last week in the tragedy at the school in Parkland, Florida.
Now, I think what you're asking about is the assault weapons ban.
Yes, sir.
So let me be honest with you about that one. If I believed that that law would have prevented this from happening, I would support it. But I want to explain to you why it would not.
Senator Rubio, my daughter, running down the hallway at Marjory Stoneman Douglas, was shot in the back.
Yes, sir.
With an assault weapon. The weapon of choice.
Yes, sir.
Okay? It is too easy to get. It is a weapon of war. The fact that you can't stand with everybody in this building and say that, I'm sorry.
Sir, I do believe what you're saying is true.
David Smiley from the Miami Herald, this must have been a closely watched event in your home state.
It was gripping television, incredibly compelling, intense to watch, to see students who had a week earlier fled out of their high school when a former classmate killed 17 teenagers and adults to pose questions and really grill senators and their congressmen and the NRA for a father who'd lost his daughter to put Marco Rubio on the spot about his positions on assault weapons and gun control in general was pretty amazing to watch.
Now, Florida, if I'm not mistaken, is a place where the NRA is pretty influential, where the number of people who are walking around armed is pretty high compared to other states in the union. Don't you have 1.5 million concealed carry permits?
More than 1.8 million.
Wow. And thus, it was no surprise, some surprise, how the legislature handled the issue this week?
Right, yeah. I think outside of South Florida, where I think, the area is very heavily Democratic and they're sort of in a cocoon of grief right now, I think most of the state realized that even as these students, these teenagers came out of the school and began to immediately turn to activism and push for gun control, it was pretty clear that their calls for an assault weapon ban were not going to be heeded by lawmakers in Tallahassee. Florida is a very pro-Second Amendment state. There are many, many gun owners, and the Republicans control not only the House and the Senate, but also the governor's office. And I think just the fact that they've been willing to consider gun control at all seems remarkable. Only last year during their legislative session, which came immediately on the heels of a terrible shooting in Orlando at the Pulse nightclub, and also a mass shooting at the Fort Lauderdale Hollywood Airport, there were no gun control laws passed. So in this instance, I think these students have already accomplished something pretty impressive by getting the legislature to move on some items. But their goal of banning assault weapons is pretty much a non-starter.
Your latest story for the Herald indicates that for all the talk about putting security guards, putting armed people in schools, in fact, there was an armed person at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was a gut punch yesterday when the Broward Sheriff's Office acknowledged that their deputy assigned to the school who was armed was not only on site but ran to the building where the shooter killed 14 teenagers and three faculty and was next to the building for upwards of 4 minutes, the sheriff said, while the shooting was occurring. And the shooter, the deputy never ran into the building. The shooter was able to actually shed his weapons and his flak vest and escape out of the building with other students and was never engaged. And for minutes, who knows how many people were killed as the school officer who's there to protect these students did nothing.
Aaron Blake, every time something like this happens, it's confidently said that this is going to be the one. This is going to be the case that changes the national conversation. Does this feel different this first week?
I've been as skeptical as anybody that it would. We've been through so many examples of this kind of thing. There was, of course, a tragedy at an elementary school in 2012, which led to a very robust debate about gun legislation in Congress. There was a bipartisan bill led by a pretty conservative lawmaker, Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, along with Joe Manchin from West Virginia. And we ultimately saw the momentum basically dissipate. We saw the conservative base, turn against this bill. And nothing wound up happening. I think if there's anything that changes this time, it's those students speaking out. And the other thing would be if the president decides that he actually wants to act, which I don't think we know for sure at this point.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about what's moving the world this week. You can join the conversation. Can you keep up with all the Russia indictments? Do you even care? Are the conservative leaders at CPAC speaking for you or not? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today, David Smiley, political reporter for the Miami Herald, Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for the Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. At CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee conference on Thursday, NRA CEO and Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre defended gun rights, saying that gun opponents are using the Florida shooting to attack the Second Amendment.
It's not bestowed by man, but granted by God to all Americans as our American birthright. So I call right now today on every citizen who loves this country and who treasures this freedom to stand and unflinchingly defend the Second Amendment, the one freedom that protects us all in this country.
Wayne LaPierre at this week's CPAC meeting. Jack Beatty, you heard what he had to say. What do you make of it?
Oh, you know, guns guaranteed by God. All one can say is Jesus wept. He is a fanatic. And, maybe nothing will happen. I tend to agree with Chris Murphy, the senator from Connecticut, who asked if Congress is apt to change. He said, no, this Congress is owned by the NRA. A new Congress voted in 2018, a Democratic Congress that might be different. But this children's crusade is really aimed at making an A from the A rating from the National Rifle Association a scarlet letter. They're going after that. They went after that with Rubio. A young man looked at him and said, you took $3 million from these people. Will you, you know, that's blood money. Are you going to repudiate that? And Rubio, who under pressure, as we saw during the presidential campaign, tends to repeat himself, he kept iterating, well, people buy into my agenda. An unfortunate use of verb there. They buy into my agenda. I don't buy into theirs. But there's going to be a lot of that. We're going to hear about the scarlet letter from these young people and from gun rights activists.
$3 million to Rubio, $3.5 million just this week for the students who are organizing against the current gun law order. From our listeners, Dev writes, if we fail to protect young people in their schools, that would be a great shame for all Americans. This should not be a political issue. Young people's lives come first before the Second Amendment. Arming teachers is rather a moronic solution and would only create a new war zone in and around schools. And Kim writes, Wayne LaPierre and GOP members who have spoken are making token, I repeat, token gestures toward solving the problem. It's just unbelievable to me that someone's right to have a gun without jumping through any hoops is more important than gun safety. President Trump is speaking to CPAC today, Friday. Aaron Blake, does the president diverge from NRA orthodoxy, from Republican Party orthodoxy, when it comes to the issue of guns?
He has to some degree in the last few days. With the president, you never know exactly what is ultimately going to happen. He tends to speak off the cuff and float ideas that he may or may not eventually ultimately subscribe to. He has talked about, for instance, raising the age limits for buying guns. He has talked about in some way reforming the background check process. He made the announcement this week about having the Justice Department craft a regulation banning bump stocks, which were the modifications that turned the gun in Las Vegas 4 months ago from a semi-automatic weapon into effectively an automatic weapon. He seems to have something of a desire to address this issue. But we've also seen that he, in a lot of ways, echoes the NRA's talking points. He's talking about arming teachers, which is a big NRA focus. And we've, of course, seen in recent debates that he ultimately may back off of some things he's calling for, the good example being the immigration debate where he put forth a bunch of items that he wanted from a deal to renew the DACA program to protect the children of illegal immigrants who were brought here, and ultimately decided that deal wasn't good enough for him and backed out of the whole thing. So, you know, it's a situation in which it's interesting that he's at least giving lip service to this idea, and maybe ultimately he'll decide to do it, but ultimately we just don't know because he's proven to be so unpredictable in following through.
David Smiley, between looming primaries and a big general election coming up in November 2018, has the incident in Parkland caught some prominent Florida politicians sort of on the wrong foot?
It has, to some extent. We've seen Adam Putnam, the state's agricultural commissioner, who is at this point a leading candidate to get the Republican nominee for governor, once called himself a proud NRA sellout. Had a petition on his campaign website. It was up Sunday. It was down by Tuesday. It was back up again after it was mentioned that he'd taken it down. Hasn't wanted to answer questions about it. Rick Scott has an A-plus rating, which, as it was mentioned, these students marching to Tallahassee have tried to indeed make that a scarlet letter. We'll see if this movement, if it lasts, if the teenagers from Stoneman Douglas High School, who their efforts seem to have spurred thousands of other high school students across South Florida to come out over the last week and protest and show them some solidarity. Does that mean that, you know, young voters coming online who typically don't vote in large numbers will suddenly steadily begin to become a regular voting bloc, a sort of single issue litmus test voting bloc in November and in 2020 to sort of shift demographics a little bit in the state? It's hard not to be cynical about that, but I think there's a possibility, and maybe they change some people's minds by being a compelling group on this point. Maybe they're swaying voters in a purple state that at the top of the ticket is typically decided by very slim margins.
Our first stop, Nashville, Tennessee. Wes, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Ray. I'm a chairperson for a political action committee here that advocates on behalf of public education and educators. And I could not be more opposed to arming teachers. I've heard teachers are not really encouraged to speak out for a host of reasons I won't get into, but ones that do have said they do not want to be armed. Pardon me for being slightly cynical here, but one could view arming teachers as a way for the NRA to get students comfortable being around guns, which only benefits the NRA long term. And to me, while that's cynical, it is troublesome, and it kind of makes sense.
Well, you know, Wes, I'm not sure that is cynical. I think when we talk about the church shooting, when we talk about nightclub shootings, when things have happened in shopping malls, the National Rifle Association has said, unremarkably, that if more people were out and about in public armed, these things would end sooner with less loss of life. They are attempting, I think it's fair to say, I'm not knocking the NRA, I think they're just trying to normalize the carrying of weapons in all different realms of life in an unremarkable way. It should not be remarkable in any way to think that in church somebody would stand up and be packing and maybe bring a church shooting to a quicker end. They want there to be guns everywhere all the time. Isn't that fair?
That is fair, though I completely disagree. Well, there's a lot of problems associated with this. Plainclothes teachers can be quickly mistaken for shooters among their peers who are also armed. And also, how do we expect a teacher? First of all, teachers don't want to be security guards, but how do we expect a teacher to have the same kind of offensive firepower as a person with an AR-15, even equipped with a bump stock? I mean, there's a whole host of problems here with arming teachers besides accidents, even if there is an active shooter situation. So I think people who want teachers to be armed are not thinking through all of the potential downsides that are associated with that.
We should, obviously, with any new policy, think about the upsides and the downsides. But I would only observe that as Americans, we tend to think of this the way we see it on TV and in the movies, that somebody with a gun would necessarily hit what they're aiming at, that in a school corridor or in a crowded classroom with people running around or a cafeteria, if someone was armed, they would hit the right person. And if you've ever been to a firing range, you know that people miss their targets and they don't hit the bullseye and they fire in ways that that are not necessarily advisable. Just this week in Idaho, a teacher who was armed in a school, they've just allowed that recently in Idaho, shot himself in the foot when there was an incident unrolling and accidentally, instead of unholstering his weapon all the way, fired and shot himself in the foot, quite literally. David Smiley, this must be encouraging all kinds of conversations about just these issues in Florida this week.
Yeah, arming teachers, what could go wrong? I don't know many teachers who are eager to also become security guards. I'm kind of curious how exactly you know, the president or the state of Florida, which is going to have this debate starting today about arming teachers, how they expect these teachers to fit in the time to become trained to protect their students, trained on how to handle an active shooter, how not to shoot each other. There just seems like a huge host of problems that would be raised by teachers being the ones expected to shoot back at someone like Nicholas Cruz. But that debate's going to happen in the state of Florida. You know, there's some nuance for some leaders about training certain members of faculty. You know, others would prefer to, like Broward Sheriff Scott Israel wants to, you know, talked about raising taxes to fund school security officers at every campus. But then we look at what happened with the trained school security officer who was there and didn't do anything about it. And so I just think there's a lot of nuances. And in that example of having an officer there who did nothing, I think everybody has something you can point to. Well, these teachers and administrators are on their own. They can't rely on police. Or you can say it points to the fact that they can have all the training in the world and it's difficult to react to something like this.
David Smiley of the Miami Herald is in Miami. Wes, thanks for your call from Nashville. When asked by reporters earlier this week if Jared Kushner would lose access to classified information as a result of a security clearance overhaul, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said she was unable to answer, but nothing has happened that would affect Jared's work.
I can't answer whether someone has security clearance or not, as we've addressed many times before, but I can tell you that nothing that has taken place will affect the valuable work that Jared is doing.
Aaron Blake, Jared Kushner is still working on the same interim clearance that he got when he was a member of the transition team. It turns out a lot of people in Trump world don't have their clearances.
Yeah, there's something going on here. It's not clear why that is. Certainly part of the reason would seem to be the fact that his administration is stocked with people who previously didn't work in government, previously didn't have security clearances. He hasn't generally culled his staff from people who were already within the Republican Party establishment. And so that's, I think, created some of these delays. In the case of Jared Kushner especially, though, the question is whether it's not just about the complexity of all this, the fact that there are so many people that need to be reviewed. The question is how much this has to do with his personal finances, how much this has to do with his possible involvement in the Mueller investigation and what they're looking into there. Is there a reason similar to what happened with Rob Porter? Is there some kind of a red flag that means he's not getting this particular clearance? And so what we have right now is what seems to be a bit of a power struggle between Jared Kushner and Chief of Staff John Kelly, who has, of course, crafted a plan that would rein in his access to highly classified information. And so the Chief of Staff of the White House is now pitted against the president's son-in-law, who happens to be a senior advisor. And I think that's a very significant clash of power within the highest levels of the White House.
Jack Beatty, a senior advisor and someone who's been given portfolios that would necessitate looking at classified information. For instance, making peace in the Middle East. It's bedeviled professional diplomats for the last 60 years. But Jared Kushner, with no experience on this, if he wants to get up to speed, he has to look at classified documents.
Yes, and we read that he reads the documents, but that the president mostly does not. So he may even know more than the president about what's happening in the world. You know, I think that this the backstory to the Porter matter and the long lack of action there is essentially, you know, Porter equals Jared. That, in other words, they protected him, they kept him going. He wasn't challenged because to challenge his lack of security clearance was to raise the question of Jared. And so he's been at the center of all of this. And you know, off stage, there's an awful lot of influence on this man. He's got The New Yorker has written about the way the Chinese have been trying to, you know, perhaps financially interested in his enterprises. He's made a apparently a Trumpianly imprudent deal in buying a building on Fifth Avenue, which is he still can't pay for. And there is that, infamous moment, two of them in the campaign, where he went to the Russian, he went to the famous meeting in Trump Tower with the others to talk about, oh, we got the dirt on Hillary. And more importantly, after the election, he said to the Russian ambassador, can we set up a secret line to the Kremlin? There's a lot going on there.
Before we get back to the show, we'd like to ask you about you. That's right. We want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous and easy. Just go to WBUR.org/survey to complete the survey right now. That's WBUR.org/survey. This survey will be tremendously helpful to us. So thanks.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. In other news this week, at least six are dead from flooding caused by severe weather across the country. Here's ABC's David Muir.
Major winter storm bringing snow, freezing rain, flooding, and a tornado watch in Louisiana for much of the day. That winter storm stretching from Texas to Maine, dangerous flooding in Dallas tonight, a woman rescued from her car in rushing waters.
After a 20-year gold medal drought, the U.S. women's hockey team won it all. At the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics, there was a nail-biting shootout against Canada.
Megan Augusta, she scored earlier. Must beat Rooney. To keep Canada's hopes alive, she is stopped! The United States wins gold in Pyeongchang!
At a CNN town hall Wednesday, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Drama Club performed Shine, an original song they wrote in the wake of the shooting at their school.
You're not gonna knock us down, we'll get back up again. You may have hurt us, but I promise we'll be stronger and we're not gonna let you in.
You can join the conversation. The devastation in Syria continues. What should be done? What are your final thoughts on Billy Graham? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are David Smiley, political reporter for the Miami Herald, Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for the Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Along with the talk about guns and Wayne LaPierre at CPAC and so on, much less talked about, and I think perhaps gaining a little bit more attention if the shooting hadn't happened, was the invitation of Marine Le Pen and Nigel Farage to speak at CPAC. If you are an American conservative, you may find yourself to the left of where Marine Le Pen is, but is it a signal that the tide is turning in the internal conversation among Republicans, among American conservatives, about immigration? President Trump's new policy would not only reduce or end illegal immigration, it would reduce immigration full stop. Aaron Blake?
CPAC is a very good little encapsulation of how the Republican Party and the conservative movement more broadly have changed during the rise of Trump. He delivered a speech there several years ago when he was dipping his toe into politics. It was viewed as not terribly serious. During the 2016 campaign, he was not invited to CPAC because he was not viewed as a serious politician. Now, even last year at CPAC, the whole thing was basically remade in his image. Now we have those nationalist leaders, foreign leaders being invited, a lot of very pro-Trump content. We seem to have moved away from what CPAC used to be, which was very much a collective of the most purity-focused Republicans, and now it's become a gathering of the most kind of Trump-focused Republicans. It's an expression of the personality-driven nature of the Republican Party now, and it's been a very rapid transformation over just the last 2 years, in fact.
Incidentally, and it's a small thing, but an American agency involved in protecting the border and clearing immigrants has taken the reference to this being a nation of immigrants out of its mission statement. David Smiley, this is something that must resonate in Florida, given the makeup of your state's population.
Yeah, you know, in this region, it's such a melting pot. I think the view here is that, you know, South Florida is the future of the country for a lot of people. You know, people from all over the world coming in to find their opportunity. And so I think to some extent there's an echo chamber for a lot of activists on immigration down here who have a hard time seeing the nationalistic point of view and seeing it as completely contrary to the future of the country.
Because Ileana Ros-Lehtinen, as she has taken herself out of the coming election, she's become more critical of the Trump administration's immigration policy and more outspoken, if that's even possible for Ileana Ros-Lehtinen, about what she sees happening inside her party. Interesting times.
Yeah, she seems to be completely unshackled and unrestrained by, you know, anything PC for views contrary to the Republican Party at this point, now that she's leaving office. And she's definitely been she's been fun to watch on social media as she espouses views and throws out some Dios míos about views on immigration and what she wants to see happen in the country.
Our listeners are weighing in from around the country. Charles writes, when I was a boy, school violence meant a student was getting the strap from his teacher, or two kids were having a fist fight in the schoolyard during recess. Nobody died from it. Rodrigo writes, I agree with NRA. Put a dedicated SWAT team in every U.S. school. Have the NRA pay for them with the money they currently use to buy congressmen and congresswomen. Arming teachers is a stupid and meaningless approach and not dealing with the issue. Mr. Twicky writes, perhaps if we prevented the bad guys from getting guns in the first place, we wouldn't need LaPierre's good guy with a gun. And Anonymous 02030 writes, Rick Scott needs to be voted out. It's inexcusable that a sitting governor leading a state that just saw 17 high schoolers shot dead cannot be bothered to attend a town hall on the meeting. Fletcher, Vermont is next. Jared, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. I just wanted to make a comment connected to the Jared Kushner piece that you had on earlier, and I think that Kushner's lack of a security clearance, one, ties directly to the Mueller investigation, and two, is a piece of the puzzle with respect to the nepotism and corruption that's quite rampant in the Trump administration. Today, Donald Trump Jr. Is in India hawking Trump-related products, and that's a company that the president is not fully divested in. Ivanka Trump has received trademarks and patents from the Chinese government after meetings with them directly. And I think that, quite honestly, a few months or a few years removed from this moment, either during the Trump presidency or after, we're going to realize the full extent of the corruption and how Trump has been ostensibly laundering money from the taxpayers into his own pockets vis-a-vis visits to his private golf courses and increasing rates at his estate in Mar-a-Lago and having four nationals stay at Trump International Hotel, you name it. But I think that's something to keep an eye on.
Jack Beatty?
Well, this is the Emoluments Clause argument, and that has been in the courts. I think one court, I think it was in, I'm not sure, Maryland, didn't allow a Washington restaurant to get standing in that. But there's no question that this is pervasive in the administration, and it's even into the policies of the administration. I mean, sort of overlooked in the massive tax cut of the GOP was the the various ways in which it advantaged the Trump business empire, scores of millions of dollars in tax breaks for him, and of course, perhaps even $1 billion or maybe more than a billion, several billion dollar windfall for his children because the estate tax has been cut back so far, perhaps even on its way to being eliminated. So self-dealing is the Trump way, and he has defended that all along in the campaign. When the issue of bankruptcies came up, you've had multiple bankruptcies. Mr. Trump, what do you say about that? He says, I was using the law. That was smart. That was my – and for whatever reason, the Hillary Clinton campaign, instead of having ad showing stiffed, plumbers and carpenters and ordinary working people, which is part of what happened in these bankruptcies. They didn't get paid. They didn't touch that issue. But his cynicism about this has been open. He hasn't tried to hide it.
There have been casualties in his own appointed leadership team. Recently, the release of an inspector general's report confirming that Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin improperly accepted gifts, misspent taxpayer money, and misused department resources on an official trip to Europe last year. Shulkin said that while the optics of the instance were not good, it's still important for the United States to work with its allied countries.
I do recognize the optics of this are not good. I accept responsibility for that. But I do believe it's important the United States continue its work with its allied countries.
Which is something you could probably do even if Mrs. Shulkin doesn't come on the trip. Aaron Blake, you're right at the heart of this. How come there isn't more activity in this realm? A lot of politicians, even ones that might have been compromised earlier in their careers, are careful to at least avoid the appearance of impropriety.
Yeah, it's been a regular feature of the Trump administration so far, these travel problems that especially cabinet secretaries have had, and there doesn't seem to have been, one, a whole lot of oversight. There doesn't seem to have been a tone set maybe from the top levels about what is acceptable and about preventing even the appearances of doing something wrong. I actually looked last week back at the 22 people that the president had initially picked for his cabinet and for cabinet-level positions. Of those 22 people, five of them have had these travel problems. One of them had to resign over it. That would be Tom Price, who is the Health and Human Services Secretary. And four others have had their own controversies over misstatements, over personal problems. So that's 9 of 22 members that of the cabinet and cabinet level positions that the president initially picked having some kind of controversy over the first 12 to 13 months of the administration. There are a lot of questions about exactly how bad these things are, but just from a vetting perspective, from an oversight perspective, I think that raises a lot of question about whether the president has indeed sought to drain the swamp, which was a phrase used frequently, and how much emphasis there has been on truly draining the swamp and preventing officials from using their government jobs for their own personal gain.
And Waxhaw, North Carolina is our next stop. Russell, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What's on your mind, Russell?
I just wanted to make, two things. First, just a comment about Billy Graham and his influence on my grandfather's life, ex-World War II vet, a man of integrity and character, but was not religious in any way, not even Christmas and Easter. But he would not miss a Billy Graham program that passed on the radio or television. And I grew up watching my grandfather have the highest respect for Billy Graham. And I just wanted to mention that. On the gun right conversation, gun laws, I think background checks would be, if we really enact that and have effective background checks, I think that would move the conversation along and have instant impact.
So you'd have to change the current law where you can buy a gun at a gun show without a background check.
Absolutely.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure I understood you correctly. I'm interested that an unreligious, not particularly observant grandfather would still be enthralled with a Billy Graham crusade. What was in it for him if he wasn't that interested?
Well, deep down in, he probably was more interested than he gave verbal consent. But I believe it was the way Billy Graham communicated with love and respect for those he was speaking to. Billy Graham could be talking to the mayor or the president or the homeless person under the bridge, and he would have the same level of respect and be able to communicate the gospel through that means.
Russell joining us from Waxhaw, North Carolina. Next to Asheville, Cecil, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Thanks for taking the call.
What's on your mind, Cecil?
Well, I'm a biographer of Billy Graham and wrote what is probably the only critical political biography of Graham. And I take great exception to the way he's being characterized now that he's died. He was very definitely a political actor. He worked Congress. He worked with the president. He invited himself to the White House over and over again. And he used that influence to bolster his own standing in the world. He worked, he conveyed information from Latin America to Kennedy. He worked with the CIA down there. And it's well documented. And to pretend that he was just a nice guy who was giving solace to the president is simply not true.
I understand he advocated for American intervention to save South Korea by using evidence of the great number of Christian converts in South Korea, right?
Yeah, he said that he told Truman there were more Christians per capita in South Korea than anywhere else in the world, which was not and has never been true. He urged Nixon to bomb dikes in North Vietnam, which would have killed millions of civilians. He worked with Saudi Arabia to get Reagan to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia. He was very clearly a political actor. And that's the piece, I think, that's missing from the story that's being told over and over again.
A little reclamation of the historical record from Cecil in Asheville, North Carolina. Was that you, Jack?
Yeah, there's an exception to that. I'm sure Cecil could give us chapter and verse, but The Economist points it out today. That is in 1982. When President Reagan was talking about the Soviet Union as the evil empire, Billy Graham accepted an invitation to attend a peace conference there. The Reagan administration, you'll be giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Don't do it. Don't go. And he said about it, I had been briefed at the Pentagon about what would happen if there was a nuclear war. I had been to Auschwitz and seen how limitless is our capacity for evil. And I was thinking about Paul, the apostle, saying in his first letter to the Corinthians that he was called to be all things to all people. I realized I had closed myself to the Soviet Union, to the people of the Soviet Union. So there you have a case of Billy Graham essentially saying to the Republican establishment, sorry, I have a moral calling here.
On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, thanks as always. Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for The Washington Post, good to talk to you.
Thank you.
And David Smiley, political reporter for the Miami Herald, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Coming up Monday, President Trump floats the idea of arming teachers to prevent another school tragedy. We'll have that debate. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.